Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram for Thursday, August 29th. ExxonMobil to sell some Permian assets. The story was written by Mella McEwen, oil editor. Mega mergers like the one that saw ExxonMobil acquire Pioneer Natural Resources earlier this summer inevitably result in divestitures and even some layoffs. In the aftermath of the merger, it was reported 59 employees had been laid off, 39 in Las Colinas, 18 from Midland, and 2 in the Concho Valley. The company had filed a work adjustment retraining notification notice, also known as a WARN notice, which is required by the Texas Workforce Commission to provide notice 60 days in advance of plant closures or mass layoffs. Quote, the WARN notice was triggered due to the number of employees that have either been offered transition roles or that have declined offers to join ExxonMobil, and in both cases will be separated under the Pioneer Severance Plan, a spokesperson for the company told the Reporter Telegram by email. Continuing the quote, our employment strategy has not changed. The success of this merger depends heavily on the retention of Pioneer's talented workforce, and more than 1,500 Pioneer employees were offered jobs as part of the merger, end quote. The merger also prompted media reports this week that ExxonMobil was planning to sell non-core assets in the Permian Basin that could fetch as much as $1 billion. Reports said the sale would involve a package of conventional oil assets in the Permian Basin, as the company focuses on growing shale production and includes older wells in the Central Basin Platform. A spokesperson told the Reporter Telegram the company does not comment on commercial details, but did confirm potential asset sales. Quote, XTO Energy, a subsidiary of ExxonMobil Corporation, is exploring market interest for select conventional assets in West Texas and Southeast New Mexico. This decision is consistent with our strategy to continually evaluate our portfolio. Operations will continue as normal throughout the marketing process, the spokesperson wrote. Andrew Dittmar, principal analyst at Enverus Intelligence Research, told the Reporter Telegram by email the sale of non-core assets after waves of corporate consolidation was not surprising. Quote, companies, including Exxon and Apache Corporation parent APA, are reportedly looking to unload non-core assets, Dittmar wrote. Perhaps to the disappointment of smaller public E&Ps and private equity firms that were hoping for the opportunity to buy Delaware and Midland inventory, they are focusing efforts on legacy assets in areas of the Permian, like the Central Basin Platform, end quote. That aligns with his company's view that buyers are looking to retain as much inventory as possible in the Midland and Delaware basins. Quote, they may also be motivated to sell these older wells, as these types of assets will be more impacted by changing regulations and fees around methane emissions, he added. Tapestry Hilton gets okay to take $5 million MDC incentive. The story was written by Trevor Hawes, editorial director. At a special meeting Monday, the Midland Development Corporation Board approved an incentive deal involving a new hotel downtown. The next day, City Council gave its blessing. By a 6-to-1 vote, council members approved MDC's $5 million incentive for LS Brentway's project to turn the building at 112 South Lorraine Street into a Tapestry Hilton hotel. In October 2023, council approved its own incentive, a 10-year hotel occupancy and property tax abatement worth about $2.3 million. The site currently has a 6-story building originally constructed in 1927 for use as a hospital. Quote, "I think it's really important to see a building we could preserve rather than tear down, and seeing this building come back to life is fantastic," MDC Chairman Lorsey Sams told the Reporter-Telegram on Wednesday. The forthcoming 80-room boutique hotel will see construction of a second 6-story tower west of the main building, and it's the boutique nature of the Tapestry Hilton that Sam said will make the place extra special. Quote, "Boutique hotels have a warmth, quietness, and quality about them," he said. "They can be secluded and comfortable, and this hotel is certainly going to be an uptick of what's currently available," end quote. The Tapestry Hilton is a project of L.S. Brentway, a group of local investors led by the Barra family, a family of physicians and investors who already own and operate several hotels across the Permian Basin. Under the agreement, the new hotel will be comprised of a total area of 34,000 square feet, 80 guest rooms, a boardroom, a market or pantry area, a fitness facility, a lounge area with lobby, and an upscale restaurant and bar. Al Escamilla, who is providing public relations support for L.S. Brentway, told council members Tuesday that the project is further along than most people think. Investors have spent the past 3 months working with Hilton. Escamilla said the hotel will employ about 60 people, including at the restaurant. The final vote was 6-to-1 in favor, with at-large councilwoman Robin Poole casting the lone vote against. Poole pulled the item off the consent agenda to allow for a public comment and further discussion. In January, Poole was one of two votes against the $45 million incentive package for the future Hotel Santa Rita, also to be located in downtown Midland. In speaking with the Reporter-Telegram on Wednesday, Poole said that she did not vote against the Tapestry Hilton or Hotel Santa Rita projects, and that she isn't against incentive packages in the form of tax abatements. However, cash incentives are not part of her philosophy as a fiscal conservative. Poole noted that she voted for the Hotel Santa Rita tax abatement incentive in October 2023. Oil editor Mella McEwen contributed to this report. Midland County employees to see new health plan in 2024. The story was written by B.K. Richter. An upcoming change to health insurance for Midland County employees will save taxpayers millions of dollars. At a special meeting Tuesday, county commissioners approved switching to Blue Cross Blue Shield of Texas, CVS Caremark, and MetLife. In all, the change will reduce health insurance program costs by about $7.6 million annually. The item was approved 3-0 by County Judge Terry Johnson and Commissioners Scott Ramsey and Diane Anderson. Commissioners Jeff Summers and Luis Sanchez were absent from the special meeting. Sean Quilden of the employee benefits firm Holmes Murphy showed commissioners the breakdown of different insurance carriers in the request for proposal. Quote, the general message here is that the response or the solicitation for county was very, very well received, Quilden said. We received a significant amount of responses, end quote. In the presentation, Blue Cross Blue Shield was noted to have offered the best medical plan based on the solicitations received by the county. Highlights include a lower Medical Administrative Service Only, or ASO, fee guaranteed for 5 years, and additional discounts for bundling services such as dental coverage and pharmacy. In addition, Blue Cross Blue Shield offers significant transition credits and wellness allowances for their members. Another factor was geographical access to services and provider disruption. Quote, the geo access looks at primary care physicians, specialists, and acute care hospitals, Quilden said. All carriers within the presentation have significant access for primary care physicians, specialists, and acute care hospitals. The provider disruption slide looks at 12 months of claims activity and top providers, end quote. The presentation highlighted Midland Emergency Center as an out-of-network facility. Ramsey suggested making an amendment that would allow the clinic to be utilized by county employees. Quote, the recommendation is to bundle medical, pharmacy, and stop loss with one carrier, Quilden said during the presentation. Blue Cross Blue Shield is recommended for COBRA, FSA, dental, and vision. MetLife is recommended for voluntary vision and worksite products. The benefits of bundling include cost savings and administrative ease, end quote. Communication and modernization of healthcare coverage to county employees are also part of the new plan. Quote, the plan is to use transition dollars and credits to create a full communication campaign, Melinda Kreitz of Holmes Murphy. The goal is to educate employees about the benefits available to them, end quote. Midland County is moving toward creating more of a digital process for benefit enrollment. The county's strategic role is to modernize the entire employee benefit experience. Currently, the process is recorded on more of a paper selection process. The death ridge over Texas is finally breaking up. The story was written by Trevor Hawes, editorial director. Every summer, a high-pressure system parks itself over Texas, causing triple-digit temperatures and little precipitation, and it has a name, the Death Ridge. Springtime storms can get very severe in the Lone Star State. Thunder and lightning join hard rains and hail, and tornadoes are a persistent threat to people and property. But when summertime arrives, this activity tends to die. Enter the Death Ridge. Quote, once it sets in, all of our springtime severe activity goes away, said Jim DeBerry, meteorologist at the National Weather Service office in Midland. Quote, it suppresses storms pretty much all summer. Once the Death Ridge shows up, it kills the rain and allows for heat and drought. End quote. The Death Ridge is a high-pressure system that typically centers around the Four Corners region and extends into Texas, DeBerry said. It lasts from about Memorial Day to Labor Day. Labor Day this year is Monday, and in looking at the weekend forecast, the Death Ridge is dissipating on schedule. Quote, right about this time of year, the jet stream in the north begins to move southward into the ridge, DeBerry said. Just like birds fly south for the winter, so too does the jet stream. End quote. The longtime Midland-based meteorologist explained that storm systems up north muscle their way down south and start pounding the ridge. It weakens the ridge over the course of a month or two and eventually opens the opportunity for storms. Quote, currently, there's a storm system north of Montana. It's the one bringing us all this cooler weather, DeBerry said. It's coming through here on Friday and pushing a cold front into the area. There's a secondary cold front coming through late Sunday night. It's basically getting rid of this ridge. In a couple of weeks, we'll start to see severe storms. Rain is in the forecast this weekend, but it will be a nice rain, not severe with flooding, DeBerry said. Temperatures will also be significantly cooler. On Friday, the high is expected to be 88 degrees, with a chance of showers increasing from 30% in the morning to 70% in the afternoon, carrying into Friday evening and Saturday. The high Saturday and Sunday will be in the mid-80s. Labor Day will be about 82 degrees, with showers likely. Major League Baseball fans looking to catch a game in the Lone Star State will be glad the Rangers and Astros play in domes. The American League West leading Astros will host the Royals and Reds this Labor Day weekend. Rain is in the forecast every day in Houston. Highs will be in the upper 80s. The Texas Rangers take on the Athletics and AL East leading Yankees. Arlington is expected to see rain and highs in the low 90s. Whether you hook 'em, gig 'em, or wreck 'em, you're going to see rain with highs in the low 90s and a chance of rain if you're traveling to catch a football game on Saturday. Here are some obituaries that appeared in the Midland Reporter-Telegram on Thursday, August 29th. Loretta Jean McClelland, age 76, of Midland, passed away peacefully on August 25th after a prolonged illness. Jean was born on July 12, 1948, in San Antonio, Texas. She spent her early years in Floresville and Smiley, Texas, before moving to Fort Stockton in high school. In 1969, Jean married her beloved husband, Jeff, and in 1976, they settled in Midland, where they raised their children. Jean spent most of her years as a homemaker. Jean was preceded in death by her parents, Herman Oda Cantrell and Elsie Alberta Reed Crabtree, as well as her siblings, Evelyn Cantrell Mazur, Joyce Cantrell Dugan, and Danny Cantrell, and infant daughter Carolyn Jean McClellan. Jean is survived by her husband of 55 years, Jeff McClellan, three children, Sheila McClellan Wilson, Gabe McClellan, and Jason McClellan, all of Midland, also by five grandchildren and one great-grandchild. A visitation will be held on Friday, August 30th, from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Funeral service will be at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel on Saturday, August 31st at 2 p.m. Graveside services will follow at Rest Haven North Cemetery. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Layla Malcolm Seal was born in Vernal, Utah in 1928 to Wiley and Irene Malcolm, and she was raised on a ranch in western Colorado where her family homesteaded the land of what is now known as Dinosaur, Colorado. She passed away on August 20th of this year. she was a lifelong member of the Episcopal Church. She attended the University of Colorado in Boulder, Colorado. Layla married William A. Bill Seal, Jr. in 1950 in Vernal, Utah. Bill was in the oil exploration business, and they moved quite a bit during their early married years. Bill died in Midland, Texas, on May 11, 2010. Layla is survived by her children, Jeffrey T. Seal and his wife Nancy, of Buda, Texas, Craig C. Seal of Glenwood Springs, Colorado, Sally Seal Opakin and husband Mark of Midland, and several grandchildren. She was predeceased by her son, Bradford W. Seal of Glenwood Springs, Colorado. Layla worked as the executive director of the Multiple Sclerosis Society of Midland and was executive director for Volunteers in Midland. She was the tour guide and public relations officer for the Museum of the Southwest. Layla was in the tour business for over 30 years and guided tours to countries around the world. Layla was a member of the Junior League of Midland. She served as president of several organizations. Please send memorials to Layla to Centennial Valley Volunteer Fire Department, attention Layla Seal donations, Post Office Box 231, Centennial, Wyoming, 82055. Bobby Jean Gann, age 95, of Midland, passed away on Monday, August 26. Graveside services will be held on Friday, August 30th at 10 a.m. at Resthaven Memorial Park, 4616 North Big Spring Street in Midland. Please visit ellisfunerals.com to leave online condolences. Mercedine Brunette Mitchell passed away on August 26. The family will receive friends from 6 p.m. until 8 p.m. Wednesday, August 28th at Gilbreth Funeral Home in Stanton. Graveside services will be held at 9:30 a.m. Thursday, August 29th at Evergreen Cemetery. Memorial service will begin at 2 p.m. at the Nally Pickle and Welch Rosewood Chapel in Big Spring. She was born in 1935. She and her twin sister Geraldine Brunette Fontenot were the youngest of five children, born to Farron and Edna Brunette in Point Blue, Louisiana. She is survived by her twin sister, her son Jimmy Mitchell, and wife Leah of Lenora, Texas, and son Michael Mitchell and wife Laura of Fort Worth, Texas. She also leaves behind seven grandchildren and four great-grandchildren and numerous nieces and nephews. Mercedine was born in a Cajun farm family during the Depression, but she said that they never went without. When Mercedine graduated from high school, she went to college, she graduated and became a registered nurse. She returned to Evangeline Parish and hired on at the hospital in Ville Platte, Louisiana. Then one day, a handsome young Texan rolled an oil field truck and broke his arm, sending him to her hospital. That was the beginning of what would become 61 years of marriage to Merle. They were at each other's side for adventures too numerous to name. Arrangements are under the direction of Gilbreth Funeral Home of Stanton. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Ermelinda Francisca Baca, age 73, of Midland, passed away on Saturday, August 24th. A Bible talk will be Saturday, August 31st at 3 p.m. at the Kingdom Hall of Jehovah's Witnesses. Arrangements were made with Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.LlewellynGarciaPipkinFH.com. Mildred Yvonne Taylor, born Smith, age 94, passed away peacefully on Thursday, July 25th. Family and friends are invited to a remembrance at Rest Haven Memorial Park, Columbaria, on Saturday, August 31st at 10 a.m., 4616 North Big Spring Street in Midland, Texas. Arrangements have been entrusted to Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit the website at www.LlewellynGarciaPipkinFH.com.
With elder fraud on the rise, financial experts offer tips to avoid getting scammed. In January, a Californian financial advisor was convicted of a federal crime and barred from working or being associated with a broker, dealer, investment advisor, municipal securities dealer, municipal advisor, transfer agent, or nationally recognized statistical rating organization after he pled guilty to fleecing more than $24 million from clients over two decades. The Ponzi investing company, which Paul Horton Smith dubbed North Star, ran from roughly the year 2000 to 2020 and exploited hundreds of victims, the majority of whom were elderly. Smith told his targets North Star was an annuity-like product that invested in real estate or the stock market while pocketing their retirement savings. The case is but one example of a worrying trend. Scamming the elderly is on the rise nationally, according to the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center. Reports of elder fraud increased by 14% in 2023, while associated losses increased by about 11%. Elder fraud takes many forms, from spoof prizes to fake emergencies involving grandchildren. The scammers snatch away more than $3 billion per year from old people, many of whom are particularly financially vulnerable. Recent cases involve AI-generated voices that perfectly mimic the target's loved ones, making for even more convincing, hyper-realistic scenarios. With the widening tech gap, the elderly are particularly vulnerable to such ploys. How can they stay vigilant and avoid being tripped into a disaster? We consult financial advisors on the best practices for staying financially safe in one's twilight years. It takes all kinds. Scams run the gamut, from telemarketers offering fake prizes to government agency impersonators. Fraudsters contact unsuspecting Americans and claim they're with the Internal Revenue Service, Drug Enforcement Administration, or Federal Bureau of Investigation. Then they demand money to mitigate threats of legal action. Criminals may also pose as health insurance companies and other organizations to steal personal information. Lonely seniors are also susceptible to romance scams. Perpetrators evoke emotional excitement and forge intimacy, exploiting older Americans' vulnerability and trust. These differ from investment scams, which coerce victims to invest in non-existent schemes. Before making rash financial decisions, do homework first to avoid sham advisors. To verify the background of an advisor, utilize Broker Check and the IAPD, Investment Advisor Public Database, says Caleb Varing, an associate wealth advisor at Farnham Financial. These free government-run tools allow people to research the background and experience of financial advisors and wealth management firms. Other industry resources like Wealth Tender include profiles with financial advisor reviews, establishing legitimacy, and offering insights into clients' experiences with advisors. Remember, there's always time to sound the alarm. If you believe you've been a victim of a Ponzi scheme, consult with an attorney, says Veering. You can file a complaint directly with the SEC and FINRA, the regulatory bodies of financial advisors, if you believe you are the victim of a Ponzi scheme. Transparency is key. Professional advisors should always be upfront and transparent to establish trust among new clients. Everything from sharing how much the financial advisor charges to their education and experience should be accessible on an advisor's website and available upon request. I ensure my clients know I'm a legitimate advisor by being transparent about my qualifications, certifications, and professional background, says Ariel Tucker, CFP and founder of Connected Financial Planning. I encourage clients to verify my registration and disciplinary history on regulatory websites. Since we work with large, well-known custodians, our clients can access information about their investments 24/7. Most reputable advisors do not need to take control of your funds to guide your investment strategy. We never take possession of our clients' funds, Tucker says, even for clients who want us to do everything for them. I emphasize the need to understand the investment strategy and to ask for clear, written explanations of how the investments work. Custody battle. One of the easiest ways to ensure clients I am a legitimate advisor is the concept of custody, says Carmen Kubanda, financial planner at Innovative Wealth Building. The custodian, like Schwab or Fidelity, should be a reputable one, and clients should be able to see all account activity. Consumers can remove advisors not acting in a client's best interest from accounts by contacting the investment provider or custodian. No permission from the advisor is needed. In addition to the above tools and precautions, seniors should continue their financial education. Many community centers, libraries, and senior organizations offer workshops and resources on financial literacy and fraud prevention. Building a solid support network of family and friends who can offer a second opinion on financial decisions is also invaluable. Staying abreast of common scams by reading the news and being updated with technology can go a long way, too. Remember that being informed and aware is the best strategy when protecting yourself and your finances from financial predators. Squeezed by inflation and politics, a Texas food bank gets creative to keep people fed. Just a short walk behind the South Plains Food Bank lies an uncommon sight in the parched region. Thousands of lush trees covered in apples, persimmons, and other fresh fruit. The 15-acre orchard has its roots in East Lubbock, a known food desert in the city of about 264,000 people. While a team harvests the apples for the food bank, the orchard is also open for visitors to take them home, too. It's one of a kind, said William Russell, the orchard manager. We have people get all the apples off the ground. It's the only orchard in Lubbock open to the public like this. The fruit from the 15-acre orchard is an integral part of the food bank's mission of feeding people in need. Nearly 4 million Texans struggle with hunger and food insecurity. About 20% of Texas children suffer from food insecurity, according to Feeding Texas, a nonprofit with 20 member food banks that reach every county in Texas. Inflation, stagnant wages, and the state's decision to pass on $450 million worth of federal summer lunch programs have only made the problem worse. For decades, food banks across the country have filled a role in helping feed people. However, these organizations, including the one in Lubbock, are also feeling the squeeze. Dina Jeffries, CEO of the food bank, said people can become vulnerable in a heartbeat, whether it be from job loss, an unexpected bill, or an emergency. Jeffries said communities are still feeling the impacts of the pandemic and inflation. If I'm going to the grocery store and saying, ouch, I can't imagine someone being food insecure, Jeffries said. Celia Cole is the CEO of Feeding Texas. Cole said more families have turned to food banks this summer. They are working with the Texas Department of Agriculture, which runs an existing summer meal program. But Cole says the food banks are being stretched thin. We're struggling to keep up, Cole said. We're feeling a lot of additional demand and turning over warehouses of food daily. Another hurdle is the long-delayed federal farm bill, an enormous legislative package that sets policies for food and agricultural programs. House lawmakers introduced their version in May, but it has since stalled. The 2018 Farm Bill was extended last year through September the 30th. Congress has just about a month to discuss, amend, and pass legislation that's estimated to be worth at least $1.5 trillion. The Farm Bill funds a wide range of programs that affect agriculture, including crop insurance and loans for farmers. It also includes several food programs, such as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program and the Emergency Food Assistance Program. Funding for nutritional programs may account for about 80% of the next Farm Bill budget. Food banks are looking to the Farm Bill for relief, Cole said, especially for increased funding to the Emergency Food Program. Through the program, the U.S. Department of Agriculture buys nutritious food from U.S. farmers. Then the food is distributed through state agencies and local food banks. In Lubbock, the South Plains Food Bank is trying to work around a problem that's become common in nonprofits, the need for more donations as inflation hits donors too. Nonprofits are seeing a drop-off in funding, said Chase Head, Chief Development Officer for the food bank. Lubbock is very generous, especially the businesses, but people have to make tough decisions on where their funds are going. Head said they've tried more creative ways to draw in donors. Last year, the food bank celebrated its 40th anniversary with an event featuring Klaus Georges, a Michelin-recognized chef. The event sold out almost overnight and raised $200,000, which helped the food bank provide 600,000 meals to about 200,000 people, according to Head. 65% of their donors that night were first-time donors. The food bank hosted the event again Saturday with a farm and orchard theme. Apples from the orchard were included in the dessert. The event was sold out, and Head said the food bank reached their goal of $250,000. This equates to 750,000 meals. The food bank also has a 5.5-acre farm nearby that grows produce like watermelon, cucumbers, and tomatoes, and has other features like pollinator gardens. The food bank also has a 5.5-acre farm nearby that grows produce like watermelon, cucumbers, and tomatoes, and has other features like pollinator gardens. The farm is used for the food bank's GRUB program, or Growing Recruits for Urban Business. Sandy Garcia, the farm manager, teaches young adults about farming and other life skills. This summer, there are about 20 working with her. On a good year, the orchard can grow anywhere from 80,000 to 150,000 pounds of apples for the food bank. Similar to the food from the farm, everything that grows at the orchard goes right to the people the food bank serves. Most people don't even know this is here in Lubbock, so when people do experience it, they're pretty excited. The orchard is open to the public, and they love having visitors, whether they want to pick up fruit or learn how to grow their own in the arid region. Donating a kidney is even safer than long thought, U.S. study shows, people who volunteer to donate a kidney face an even lower risk of death from the operation than doctors have long thought, researchers reported Wednesday. The study tracked 30 years of living kidney donation and found that by 2022, fewer than one of every 10,000 donors died within 3 months of the surgery. Transplant centers have been using older data, citing a risk of 3 deaths per 10,000 living donors, in counseling donors about potential deadly surgical complications. The last decade has become a lot more safe in the operating room for living donors, said Dr. Dori Segve, a transplant surgeon at NYU Langone Health. He co-authored the study published in the journal JAMA, Journal of American Medicine. Newer surgical techniques are the key reason, calling for guideline updates to reflect those safety improvements and maybe increase interest in living donation. He often finds transplant recipients more worried about potential risks to their donors than the would-be donors themselves. For them, this is even more reassuring to allow their friends or family to donate on their behalf. Thousands of people die each year waiting for an organ transplant. It's possible for living donors to give a one of their two kidneys or part of a liver, the only organ that regenerates. With nearly 90,000 people on the U.S. list for kidney transplant, finding a living donor not only shortens the years-long wait, those organs also tend to survive longer than ones from deceased donors. Yet last year, just 6,290 of the nation's more than 27,000 kidney transplants came from living donors, the most since before the pandemic. Safety isn't the only barrier to living donation. So is awareness, as many patients are reluctant to ask. And while the recipient's insurance covers medical bills, some donors face expenses such as travel or lost wages as they recover. The NYU team analyzed U.S. records of more than 164,000 living kidney donations from 1993 through 2022 and found 36 post-surgical deaths. Most at risk were male donors and those with a history of high blood pressure. Only 5 of those deaths occurred since 2013. That period coincided with U.S. transplant centers switching to minimally invasive kidney removal, as well as adopting a better way to stop renal artery bleeding. Over time, it's a safe operation that's become even safer. Important for would-be donors to know, said Dr. Amit Tavar of the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, who wasn't involved in the study. But there are long-range risks to consider, too, he stressed, including whether a donor's remaining kidney is expected to last the rest of their life. The risk of a donor later experiencing kidney failure also is small and depends on such factors as obesity, high blood pressure, smoking, and family history of kidney disease. Risk calculators help doctors determine a potential donor's likelihood of later-in-life trouble, and transplant centers may have slightly different eligibility criteria. There's no such thing as a moderate or high-risk donor. Either you're perfect or you're not, is how Tavar puts the decision to accept or turn away a potential donor. Doctors once thought young adults were the ideal living donor, but there's a shift, however, toward more older living donors because it's easier to correctly predict that they won't outlive their remaining kidney. If a living donor later experiences kidney failure, they get priority for a transplant, he noted. Labor Day trip tips for those traveling with a loved one with dementia. If you are one of the many people taking an end-of-summer getaway this Labor Day weekend, there are several steps you should take if you are also traveling with someone who has dementia. The Alzheimer's Foundation of America is offering 7 tips to help caregivers traveling with a loved one with a dementia-related illness make their trip as smooth as possible. One last summer trip on Labor Day weekend can mean dealing with heavy traffic and packed airports, challenges which become even greater if you're traveling with someone who has dementia. Jennifer Reeder, LCSW, AFA's Director of Educational and Social Services, said in a news release, "Whether it's a quick road trip or flying far away, there are preparations and adaptations caregivers should make to help their loved ones with dementia feel more comfortable and relaxed while traveling." AFA recommends taking the following 7 steps. Simplify the itinerary. Keep the travel schedule simple. Avoid tight connections or multiple stops if possible. Resist the urge to plan a trip with too many sites, destinations, and attractions. Focus on creating quality time rather than on the quantity of activities. Plan around the person's abilities and routine. Incorporate the person, their abilities, and needs into the arrangements. If they travel better at a specific time of day, consider planning accordingly. Small changes can feel overwhelming and stressful to someone with dementia. So, to the greatest extent possible, preserve the person's routine. For example, if they normally eat around a certain time, build that into the itinerary. Choose the travel mode and scheduling that causes the least amount of anxiety and stress possible. Stock up before leaving. Bring snacks, water, activities, and other comfort items. For example, a blanket or the person's favorite sweater. Include an extra comfortable set of clothing appropriate for differences and changes in climate. Take important health and legal related documentation, a list of current medications, and physician information with you. Ensure that the person with dementia wears an ID bracelet with your contact information. If traveling by mass transit, know the security procedures. Inquire in advance with airports, train stations about security screening procedures. This way you can familiarize the person beforehand with what will happen at the checkpoint, thus reducing potential anxiety. The Transportation Security Administration, or TSA, offers assistance with the screening process to air travelers with certain medical conditions, including dementia-related illnesses. Contact their TSA Cares helpline at least 72 hours prior to your flight to learn more. Advise the airline. Let the airline know that you are traveling with someone who has memory impairment and inform them of safety concerns and special needs. Find a quiet space. Some airports have designated quiet areas or rooms for individuals living with dementia, providing a more peaceful space away from the crowds and noise. Build in break time. Take regular breaks on road trips for food, bathroom visits, and rest. Families with questions about traveling with someone who has a dementia-related illness can speak with a licensed social worker through the AFA helpline by phone 866-232-8484, text message 646-586-5283, or web chat at www.alzfdn.org. The helpline is available 7 days a week. West Texas Symphony opens with Dvorak. West Texas Symphony's 67th season opens on September the 7th at the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center. The concert, titled American Stories, takes place at 7:30 p.m., featuring timeless works for orchestra which were written in America in the early 20th century. We are excited to welcome Ethan Blake to the Permian Basin. If you have not been to hear your symphony orchestra recently, mark your calendars, Ethan Wills, executive director, said in a news release. The night begins with Antonín Dvořák's Cello Concerto in B minor, written in New York in 1894 for his cellist friend Hanás Wijhán. The piece is highly favored among cello works and known for its rich composition. Featured cellist Ethan Blake has played around the world for a variety of audiences. As a soloist, chamber, and orchestral musician, Blake has performed a wide variety of repertoire in venues across the United States, Italy, and Japan. He was an avid performer in the Front Range of Colorado and served as assistant principal cello in the Boulder Philharmonic and as a member of the Boulder Chamber Orchestra. He has appeared as principal cellist with ensembles such as the Fort Collins Symphony, the Greeley Philharmonic, and the Aspen Conducting Academy Orchestra, and has also performed with the Colorado Symphony, Rochester Philharmonic, and the Alabama Symphony. As a teacher, Blake has served as a cello instructor at the Boulder Symphony Music Academy and has a teaching artist at El Sistema, Colorado, along with working frequently with middle and high school cello sections around the area. He currently serves on the faculties of the ROC Music Collaborative and Eastman Community Music School. A graduate of the University of Colorado, Boulder, Ethan is currently pursuing a Master's of Music at the Eastman School of Music. The evening's finale showcases the orchestra's artistry with William Grant Still's Symphony No. 1. Known as the Dean of Afro-American Composers, he made his impression on classical music forever. He was the first African-American to conduct a major American symphony orchestra and the first to have a symphony performed by a major American orchestra. Still was one of the major figures and the leading classical musician of the Harlem Renaissance. Tickets are $12 to $60 and can be purchased at WTXS.org or by calling 800-514-3849. Student tickets are just $12 with a paying adult or valid college ID. Grand and Masterworks series will be available until September the 7th.
Here is the Dear Abby column that appeared in the Midland Reporter-Telegram on Thursday, August 29th. Husband can't be bothered to help with wife's needs. Dear Abby, I recently scheduled a last-minute consultation with my doctor that might result in surgery. My husband has a meeting during that time, which isn't actually necessary, but he feels he needs to attend. I feel he is choosing a non-urgent obligation over my more immediate concerns. All that said, I am capable of handling what comes my way by myself. I was just hoping for some emotional support from my spouse of 31 years. I have had plenty of that financially, but not emotionally. I'm trying to figure out why he's not taking my medical issue as seriously as I am. Signed, On My Own in Washington. Dear OMO, what a sad letter. After 31 years, you may have to accept that financial support is all your husband is capable of giving. Because you need emotional support, consider asking a close friend or relative to stay close while you resolve your medical issue. Although it may not be your first choice, it would be the more practical solution. Dear Abby, my father left my older sister and me out of his will. He inherited money, went to an Ivy League university, and raised two sets of stepkids. I know he didn't have a lot left at the end, but what there was went to his third wife. We had hoped he would help his granddaughters with cars, etc. I wish we had discussed it beforehand so it wouldn't have spoiled our larger-than-life memories of him. Are we selfish to feel let down? Signed, Still Missing Dad in California. Dear Still Missing, your feelings are your feelings. If your father led you to believe your children were in his will, then those feelings are justified. However, if he didn't do that, you are wrong to have expected him to buy cars, etc., for your children. Considering his marital history, his widow may need every penny he left her. Dear Abby, I have a neighbor I truly love. I garden, she does not. Despite my asking her 2 years ago not to take any of my asparagus, yesterday she mentioned in conversation, "I love your asparagus. Sometimes I pick some for myself." Abby, last year I was left with only enough for one meal for myself. How can I say to her, "Stop raiding my food source"? I live on a limited budget. Many times I can't afford to buy vegetables, which she is aware of. I'm very hurt by her behavior. Thank you for any insight you might give. Signed, Out of the Garden in Pennsylvania. Dear Out, sit your light-fingered neighbor down and remind her of some facts of your life. Tell her again that you are on a limited budget and grow vegetables because they have become too expensive for you to buy. Also, remind her that you have asked her before not to do what she has been doing, and tell her how hurt you are that she would steal from you. It is the truth, and she needs to hear it. She should be ashamed of herself. Contact Dear Abby at www.dearabby.com or Post Office Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.